it's Monday, April 29, and time for the Des Moines Register. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and from USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuRegister, across the state, should be breezy Monday with times of clouds and sun. Winds west-southwest 12 to 25 miles per hour. On Tuesday, watch for strong thunderstorms. Winds south 10 to 20 miles per hour. And the forecast for the next few days in central Iowa looks like this. Breezy Monday with times of cloud and sun. Winds west-southwest 12 to 25 miles per hour. Clear Monday night with winds south 6 to 12 miles per hour. High today of 67 and a low of 49. On Tuesday, strong afternoon thunderstorms with a high of 81 and a low of 55. On Wednesday, rain in the afternoon, high of 73 and low of 55. On Thursday, look for a high of 70, a low of 49, and a little afternoon rain. Tracking precipitation in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Saturday, we had seen 45 one-hundredths of an inch of precipitation. That doesn't take into account, looks like, later in the day on Saturday and those rain on Sunday afternoon. Our month to date, we've had 2.02 inches and against a normal of 3.51 inches. Our year to date is 6.73 inches against a normal of 8.16 inches. Last year on this date, we had had 7.46 inches of precipitation. Sunrise today is at 6:14 a.m. Sunset tonight, 8:11 p.m. Moonrise today, 1:30 a.m. And moonset today, 10:05 a.m. Turning now to the front page of the Register, all three front page stories today are weather-related. There is additional Iowa news inside the front page section, which we'll return to after we do Metro and Iowa. But for now, the front page stories read like this. Tornadoes wreak havoc, much of Ringgold County and in Pleasant Hill. And a Minden man, hurt, dies the next day. And here with the first story is Nicole.
I'll start with the Ringgold County story, and then we'll just ping-pong back and forth as far as the rest of the tornado coverage from the Register. So this is from Kevin Baskins of the Des Moines Register. Much of Ringgold County is now devastated. Before these stories, there's a large aerial image of just the devastation that this community seen. This shot is actually from Minden. We're going to have more on that later, but you can definitely see destruction of homes. You can barely see that this area used to be a home because of all the debris that the tornado has swept. Anyway, so we're going to go back to Ringgold County now. So Mitchell Gilland was standing in the garage of his Tingley home on Friday night when he saw a tornado coming. Said his wife says, "I heard him scream, 'Get in the basement.'" Charity is his wife, and then what followed were frantic, frightening seconds as the couple scrambled to get five children to safety. Charity said, "We were literally tossing the kids down the stairs." Mitchell, bringing up the rear, was standing on the landing leading to the basement and next to the back door when the garage disappeared right before his eyes. When they finally felt safe to leave the basement, the family could assess the damages. Windows on the south side of the house were broken, and upstairs, where the bedrooms were located, was even worse. Most of the roof was gone. Charity said of the house on Saturday afternoon, as the cleanup effort was in full swing all around her, "It is not fixable. It's a total loss." Two tornadoes swept through Ringgold County on Friday, with the third traveling nearly 26 miles across the county near Mount Air. The Tingley tornado traveled an estimated 10 miles, and it was classified as an EF2 by the National Weather Service, with peak wind speeds of 125 miles an hour. Now, despite the widespread property damage from Friday's storm, Ringgold County residents were fortunate that there were no deaths or serious injuries. The southwest city will likely be without electricity for 2 or 3 days. This is according to Alliant Energy crews, who are working to restore lines because the tornado badly damaged a substation. The Tingley Community Building was also destroyed in this storm. Tingley is a town of less than 200 people in northern Ringgold County, and it was busy with cleanup efforts on Saturday afternoon, all keeping an eye on the sky as another storm was predicted by later. That sounds grammatically wrong, but I think what they're trying to say is that there's another storm that was predicted to arrive by later in the day. They said that they had no warning that Friday's tornado was coming. Charity Gillen says there were no sirens. Part of the problem was that electricity was out by the time the tornado hit, said Earl Briner, who was watching TV with his wife Colleen before the storm arrived. If we could have had WHO-TV meteorologist Ed Wilson on, we might have known it was coming. Briner says that he and his wife first realized the severity when 4 of their windows blew out, forcing the retired couple to scramble and put up plastic to keep the rain away. By Saturday afternoon, the Briners were wandering a debris-strewn field that's north of their house, looking for electric meters that had been blown off their damaged home. They said, "We really want to find it, that meter, because of the Alliant Energy crew told us it cost $1,500 to replace." Briner added that they did not have homeowners insurance because they used a wood-burning furnace that prevented them from getting a policy. The tornado that passed through the tiny Ringgold County town of Tingley was indiscriminate in wreaking devastation. I'm not sure what that sound was. But anyway, I'm going to keep reading until we're told otherwise. Anyway, some people were left homeless while other homes appeared to be unscathed. One yard has a full-size RV flipped on its side while another struck a nearby tree.
Nicole, I'm going to interrupt you. That sound that sounded so loud here, that's the fire alarm here in the Park Fair complex. So we want you to know that that's what that was. But Scott is going to check it out. He's pretty sure it's a false alarm because that apparently happens sometimes. But we don't want you to be alarmed if that happens again. If it really is an alarm, Scott will come and get us and we will tell you. So I'm going to give it back to Nicole now so you can go ahead.
I love how my natural instinct was, okay, there's an alarm. I'm going to keep reading. So I'll just start off with this top of this graph once again. This is severe storms devastates much of Ringgold County. So the tornado that passed through the tiny Ringgold County town of Tingley was indiscriminate in wreaking devastation. Some people were left homeless, while other homes appeared to be unscathed. One yard had a full-size RV flipped on its side, while another was stuck in a nearby tree. The Mount Air tornado, which ran parallel to the one in Tingley, was classified as an EF1 with a maximum wind speed of 110 miles an hour. The rotation lasted nearly 45 minutes, touching down around 7:30 p.m. with a width of 300 yards, according to the National Weather Service. The storm left an estimated 40 to 50 homes uninhabitable in Ringgold County. This is according to the Ringgold County Emergency Management Coordinator, Melissa Stark. Damage was also reported at some hog facilities and at an operation with 500 head of cattle. Stark did not know how many livestock were lost. She said at least one Amish farm sustained home and outbuilding damage. The tornado likely formed out of a second weather system that crashed through Ringgold County on Friday. The earlier storm tracked to the west, Stark says. We think this was a second cell separate from one that had been tracking earlier, starting in the southwest corner of the county, Stark says. I think this one started in Worth County in Missouri, and there just wasn't much warning. It was just moving so quickly. Power lines went down as the first storm passed through around 8 p.m. The second system arrived in Tingley less than 45 minutes later at 8:39 p.m. Stark says Ringgold County is going to make a request to the state for disaster assistance.
And our next story is from Pleasant Hill, where a twister was an EF2. The tornado that tore through the heart of Pleasant Hill on Friday has been classified as an EF2, according to the National Weather Service. The twister was one of at least 10 confirmed tornadoes that terrorized the state, including one that devastated the town of Minden. There we go with that fire alarm again. I hope that's I'm confident that's a false alarm. So we'll continue with the report of the twister that devastated the town of Minden. The Pleasant Hill tornado was on the ground roughly 12 minutes with estimated maximum wind speeds of 125 miles per hour, ending around 9:12 p.m. The National Weather Service believes the rotation was at least 300 yards wide. It first touched down in southeast Des Moines near Indianola Avenue around 8:50 p.m., traveling for 7.2 miles past James W. County Park and northeast through Pleasant Hill. 6 of the 10 confirmed tornadoes have been classified as EF2. A pair of EF2 tornadoes traveled parallel to each other near... That is a really loud sound, isn't it? A pair of EF2 tornadoes traveled parallel to each other near Afton, while the weakest and short-lived tornado was confirmed near Moffett in Madison County, classified at EF0. The National Weather Service has not categorized the Minden tornado that destroyed the small western town on Friday, Three additional tornadoes were confirmed in Union County, and 2 were confirmed in Ringgold County. The Weather Service has also confirmed a tornado that touched down in Jasper County, one in Madison County, and another near the town of Osceola. An EF2 tornado tore through the small Ringgold County town of Tingley Friday, leaving the community without electricity. The twister also destroyed the Tingley Community Center. 3 separate EF2 tornadoes touched down 90 minutes Friday night, including one that traveled through Creston and hit an assisted living facility. The first Union County tornado is believed to have touched down at roughly 6:52 p.m. outside of Creston. The EF2 tornado traveled 6.8 miles to the northeast at a width of 350 yards with an estimated peak wind speed of 125 miles an hour. The first of 2 EF tornadoes that traveled near Afton touched down at roughly 7:26 p.m. on April 26, traveling nearly 11 miles and lasting 18 minutes. The National Weather Service believes the tornado reached a maximum wind speed of 130 miles an hour and was 150 yards wide. A second EF2 tornado popped up a few minutes after the first expired, touching the ground almost in the same spot at 7:53 p.m. The National Weather Service believes this tornado traveled 11.7 miles, lasting 12 minutes, with a maximum wind speed of 125 miles an hour and a width of 150 yards. The small town of Tingley in Ringgold County may be without electricity for several days after an EF2 tornado swept through April 26, one of 2 that touched down that night. An EF1 tornado traveled nearly 27 miles outside Mount Air and reached speeds of about 110 miles per hour. The twister touched down at 7:27 p.m. and lasted until 8:08 p.m. No injuries or fatalities were reported. An EF2 tornado ripped through Tingley on April 26, traveling about 10 miles starting around 8:19 p.m. At its peak, it reached 125 miles an hour, destroying homes and the Tingley Community Center. No injuries or deaths were reported. An EF2 tornado was confirmed to have torn through Osceola on April 26, producing some of the strongest confirmed wind speeds. The twister was just 75 yards in width, but is believed to have reached a speed of 135 miles an hour during its 12-minute, nearly 7-mile plunge through the county. The National Weather Service indicates the tornado first touched down west of Interstate 35 before heading northeast, hopping the interstate and through the heart of downtown Osceola. Excuse me. The tornado eventually dissipated a few miles northeast of town. An EF0 tornado touched down in Moffett, Madison County at 8:23 p.m. on April 26. It reached a peak wind speed of 80 miles an hour and traveled just 1.7 miles, lasting 3 minutes with an estimated width of 30 yards. An EF1 tornado touched down around 9:42 p.m. in Monroe in Jasper County and reached 105 miles an hour, traveling just 2 miles with a width of 50 yards. No injuries or deaths resulted from these twisters.
guess that last sentence doesn't really work. There has been a death that's reported from the Twister, and that is our next story. The Minden man who was hurt has now died. The state of emergency also declared for that town. This is from Virginia Beretta of the Des Moines Register. A man who was injured during a tornado that touched down in Minden has now died. Pottawatomie County Emergency Management officials confirmed that information on Sunday. The Minden resident was found after the tornado hit and was taken to a local hospital on Friday. He was later transported to a trauma center in Omaha. He passed away in the overnight hours on Saturday, according to Pottawatomie Emergency Management Director Doug Reed. Officials declined to release further information or identity information about this man. Authorities in the small southwest Iowa town declared a state of emergency after the tornado damaged 180 homes and injured 4 people. Reed says roughly 40% of those homes were destroyed. Drivers in a town of about 600 people were redirected on Saturday as those workers tried to clean up massive debris that's left behind by the Twister. 3 Pottawatomie County residents were injured on Friday night, according to Reed. They were treated and then released. Since then, 3 more have suffered minor injuries during cleanup and recovery, including 1 responder and 2 community members. Local officials did implement a town curfew from 10 p.m. Sunday until 6 a.m. Monday. Only people who live in town and emergency responders will be allowed to enter that community starting at 8 a.m. today. Reed says it's just responders, residents, utility companies, and folks doing work. We are not open to the general community. Reed says the information on how to help the community affected by the tornado will be released later on Sunday when emergency management officials assess disaster survivor needs. The emergency management officials said that no additional supplies were needed as of Sunday. The National Weather Service in Des Moines posted on social media on Saturday, according to preliminary reports, at least 10 tornadoes have touched down in central Iowa on April 26. We know that number has now updated to 12, but 6 of those tornadoes, as this report came out, says that the tornadoes have been confirmed as an EF2. National Weather Service Omaha issued 42 tornado warnings on Friday. The Weather Service reported that. A pair of EF2 tornadoes traveled parallel each other near Afton, while the weakest and shortest-lived tornado, classified as an EF0, was confirmed near Moffitt in Madison County. A tornado near Mount Air in southern Iowa is believed to have traveled 26 miles that lasted nearly 45 minutes. The National Weather Service has not yet categorized the Minden tornado that destroyed the small western Iowa town on Friday.
And that concludes the stories on the front page of the Register. We'll move now to the Metro and Iowa section. The headline story reads, State Court says the auditor possibly violated the law. Iowa Auditor Rob Sands' office may have violated state open records law in withholding records of several email exchanges with journalists requested by a conservative lawyer, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled on Friday. The dispute arises from a June 2021 report in which Sand, a Democrat, accused Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, of inappropriately including her own image in public awareness ads to stop the spread of COVID-19. A state ethics panel rejected that claim, finding the law in question has an exception for a declared disaster emergency like the pandemic. In the wake of the report, the Kirkwood Institute, a public interest law firm founded by prominent Iowa Republican attorney Alan Ostergren, filed a records request for the auditor's communications with 2 reporters in connection with the report. The auditor's office provided some records but withheld others, citing several exceptions to Iowa's open records law. Sand also did not provide 1 email his chief of staff, John McCormley, had sent to liberal journalist Laura Bellin, which she subsequently quoted on her Bleeding Heartland news blog. Only after Ostergren sued did Sand's office eventually turn over that email chain. Ostergren argued in court that the delayed release of the emails violated the law and also challenged Sand's rationale for withholding other emails. A district judge privately reviewed the withheld emails and sided with Sand, finding the delay in providing the email to Ostergren was what the judge called reasonable and dismissing the case. Sands' office told the Des Moines Register at the time it was not the lawful custodian of the emails, but in court it instead argued the emails were not found well after I may have read that wrong, or maybe it doesn't make sense. Let's try it again. Sands' office told the Des Moines Register at the time it was not the lawful custody of the emails, meaning that Sands' office was not the lawful custodian of the emails. But in court, it instead, again, Sands' office instead argued the emails were not found until well after Ostrogan sued the sued because they were sent from McCormley's personal email. The Supreme Court questioned that claim Friday as it unanimously revived Ostrogan's lawsuit, finding that a jury might view Sands' delay as unreasonable under the circumstances. Justice Matthew McDermott noted in his opinion that Ostrogan had specifically asked about the missing email to Bellin, putting in question Sands' claim not to have been aware of it. Kirkwood put the auditor's office on notice of the failure to produce this email when Kirkwood filed its petition by specifically identifying the email as improperly withheld, McDermott wrote, noting even after the lawsuit that Sand took nearly 4 months to turn over the emails. McDermott's finding opinion goes on to say Kirkwood presented enough evidence to permit a fact finder to conclude that as to this email, the auditor's office delay was unreasonable. While the email has still been provided, had still been provided to Ostrogan, McDermott noted Ostrogan still could be entitled to attorney's fees for his lawsuit under a Supreme Court decision last year, faulting the governor for long delays in responding to records requests. The justices also directed the district court to take a closer look at 9 email chains it had permitted Sand to withhold, supposedly because they were records received as part of what were called an audit or examination, quoting from the opinion there. The Supreme Court did agree that a 10th message chain should be withheld under a separate legal provision, allowing the government in some circumstances to withhold messages received from outside tipsters. Ostrogan, in an email, noted Sand has publicly proclaimed the importance of public access to records. Quoting here from Ostrogan, Rob Sand has said that officials who don't comply with the open records laws should be held accountable. I agree. He should be held accountable, and the Supreme Court's decision paves the way for that. The court made clear that he cannot hide all emails with bloggers behind his audit powers. We look forward to the opportunity to go back to district court to hear Sand's justification for hiding these emails for so long. That's the end of the quote from Mr. Ostrogan. Sonia Heitzhusen, a spokeswoman for Sand's office, said in an email the case would continue. We are disappointed in the need for additional proceedings, but we'll continue to follow the law and protect whistleblowers and tipsters, as always, Heitzhusen said. Sand, Iowa's sole Democratic statewide office holder, has repeatedly butted heads with Republican leaders and the state party. In a statement, said Friday's ruling shows Sand is, quoting here, corrupt and cannot be trusted in office. The auditor needs to stop with the self-righteous attitude and get his own house in order before preaching about government transparency, Iowa GOP Chairman Jeff Kaufman said. This is a clear violation of the law, and Auditor Sand and his office need to be held accountable, said Kaufman.
All right, next story. Buildings may take on new life after move. Relocation of police armory does bring potential. This is from Addison Lathers of the Des Moines Register. The city of Des Moines is considering a variety of new public-friendly uses for buildings on the Des Moines riverfront that will be vacated when several city offices and the police department move to a former Nationwide Mutual Insurance office building on the west side of downtown. Economic Development Coordinator Carrie Krause said on Thursday that the city is already seeing interest from prospective buyers. Krause says during a forum that's held by the Business Record, we have had a lot of inquiries. I think we'll follow a traditional process in how we approach these, but these are a lot different than a traditional land sale that the city might deal with. The upcoming but yet unscheduled move to the T.M. Franklin County City Administration Building at 1200 Locust Street will empty out police headquarters at 25 East 1st Street and the Argonne Armory at 602 Robert Ray Drive. Both were part of a group that seven government buildings constructed along the Dongguan River in the early 20th century. The armory built in 1934 was the last. In 2018, the city looked at potentially selling the armory, with private investors stepping forward with proposals for apartments, retail space, and corporate offices. Among them was Los Angeles-based performance venue operator Live Nation Entertainment, which aimed to build a 2,000-person auditorium in the armory's original gymnasium and an 800-seat venue in its Legion Hall area. Des Moines then later walked back its plan to sell that building after a study showed that relocating staff would cost more than previously thought. Live Nation then went on to build the Vibrant Music Hall in Waukee that opened last November. But now Krause says the city is more interested in community impact than return on investment. She added that she personally hopes to see plans that would support the arts and small businesses, like a space for a maker's market. She says for the civic buildings, there will be a greater focus on how we can really activate these spaces and still make them spaces the public can come to enjoy. The city will eventually solicit proposals from developers for the two sites, although Krause did not provide a timeline. The police station is three stories tall and it's 77,312 square feet. It last was remodeled in 2013, and the Polk County Assessor listed as being in very good condition. The two-story, 67,392-square-foot Argonne Armory, on the other hand, is less than pristine. Originally a National Guard training facility, it currently houses Des Moines Human Services, Community Development, and Information Technology staffs. The roof has leaked several times. This is according to Assistant City Manager Matt Anderson, telling the Des Moines Register. Both do sit on the east bank of the Des Moines River, with the armory just north of City Hall and the Brenton Skating Plaza, and are listed as part of the Civic Center Historic District in the National Register of Historic Places.
And this next article is accompanied by a picture of a cyclist in a wooded area, and the title is Cycling Lover's Haven, 4 Mile Mountain Bike Park in Des Moines is set to open this fall. Mountain bike enthusiasts are in for a gnarly ride with a dedicated park expected to open later this year on Des Moines' east side. Despite its rocky start, construction is slated to begin this spring for Polk County Conservation's 4 Mile Mountain Bike Park, a cycling lover's haven. Packed with banked turns and terrain jumps, county officials say the park's trails will take cyclists of all ages and levels of experience on what they call a terrain-packed roller coaster experience. President of the Central Iowa Trail Association, known as CITA, C-I-T-A, Dave McCloney, said the park will likely draw people of all ages, including families, primarily from the Des Moines Metro. But as the word gets out, he hopes it will attract people from the region. CETA, which was formed in 1996, is an organization that works with local governments to maintain single-track trails, primarily for mountain biking in the Des Moines area. It's kind of for everybody, McCloney said. It's for an expert rider, or it can be a place for beginner riders, he said. Here's what to know about the upcoming 4 Mile Mountain Bike Park. The roughly 50-acre park is in a wooded area of undeveloped land north of Copper Creek Lake. It's located north of East University Avenue on the border of Des Moines and Pleasant Hill. Polk County Conservation Park planner Adam Fendrick said while the site's extensive tree coverage does not serve as what's called ecologically valuable timber, a resource because it is not in the state's native oak hickory. The canopy makes it conducive for mountain biking. For the environment, we're in and for recreational value, the trees there are great for that, Friedrich said. I'm sorry, his name is Fendrick. The park will feature a soft surface two-way perimeter trail geared toward recreational mountain biking, but that also can accommodate hikers, runners, walkers, and bird watchers. From the perimeter trail, there will be about a half dozen single-track, one-way trails that will have different styles and different difficulty, according to Fendrick. The courses, designed by the International Mountain Biking Association, will include traditional trails that follow the natural landscape, flow trails, which provide riders with smooth tracks with banked turns and quick up-down terrain jumps, gravity trails that focus on downhill riding, and technical routes, which can include more obstacles like trees, roots, and rocks. The idea is 3 miles isn't a lot of trail, but what the design of this is, when you start looping them, you turn that 3 miles into 9 miles, 12 miles, however many loops you want to do, Fendrick said. While it will not be included in the first phase, conservation officials are leaving space for a future skills area and pump track, a track that requires the cyclist to use a pumping motion rather than pedaling, which will provide beginners with a spot to practice on a surface that mimics the terrain before getting on the courses. Last year, county officials restored the timberland in the park by cutting down invasive species. Next year, officials plan to stabilize the slopes to an unnamed creek, a restoration to improve water quality going into the Four Mile Creek watershed. There will be a lighted parking lot and a connection to the nearby Gay Lee Wilson Trail. The Conservation Board purchased the land for $300,000 in 2021 to develop it into parkland, according to Polk County Conservation spokesperson Jessica Laun. The first phase for the park is estimated at $1.2 million, Fendrick said, much of which has been secured through grants and bonds, including $200,000 from the National Park Service's Land and Water Conservation Fund, a $400,000 federal and state recreational trails grant from the Iowa Department of Transportation, and a $2,500 grant from the International Mountain Biking Association. CETA also donated funds to the park, Fendrick said. Iowa ranks near the bottom of the 50 states for recreational land, according to Polk County Conservation. Meanwhile, trail usage in the county's conservation areas increased by more than 40% in 2020, creating crowded trailheads and an obvious need for more single-track trails, according to the county's website. Officials say the park is meant to provide an escape to nature within an urban setting. McCloney said CETA has more than 200 families that are members. While the mountain biking community makes up a small percentage of the bicycling community as a whole, McCloney said the organization is working to get more data on trail usage to better understand ridership. The Four Mile Mountain Bike Park will join the ranks of other nearby mountain bike parks, including the county-owned Sycamore Trails and city-owned Center Trails, Denman's Woods, Grandview, and Ewing Trails. The park is slated to open by late summer or early fall, according to Polk County Conservation Director Rich Leopold.
And here's what we know about the proposed East Village Park from Addison Lathers of the Des Moines Register. Planned construction of a stormwater basin in Des Moines East Village this year could usher in a major side benefit, a city park and recreation area in the growing residential district. The city has long known that it would need a basin on the eastern side of the Market District development adjacent to the East Village to help manage stormwater runoff. Original plans showed a pond surrounded by native plants. But as conversations continued, Parks and Recreation Director Ben Page said an idea emerged to kill two birds with one stone by situating the basin in a way that would leave space available for other uses. He says, as they carved out a stormwater basin, we said, hey, that's already city land. Let's just work with our friends in Public Works to get a corner. We don't have to buy land for stormwater and a park. We just need the one. New rendering showed a promenade, pavilion, and playground, as well as basketball and multi-sport courts, larger than the Mid-American Energy Two River Parks overlooking the Des Moines River, under construction on the other side of the Market District. East Village Park would extend from the Southeast 14th Street Bridge on the east to the East 7th Street on the west. Bordering it on the north would be an existing rail line and also a walking trail. Recreational value, the trees there are great for that, Frederick says. Oh wait, no, this is a I think I'm reading the wrong story here. Sorry, I am reading the wrong story. So this is supposed to read, bordering it on the north would be an existing rail line and also a walking trail extending through the Market District from the Red Bridge over the Des Moines River. And on the south, a spur of Elm Street and another rail line separating it from an industrial area north of the East Martin Luther King Jr. Parkway. It would be the third park in the Des Moines area to take advantage of stormwater management needs after Cohen Park, south of MLK Jr. Drive, and then the proposed East 9th Street Basin Park in the Highland Park area. Let's see, Paige says we have thousands of folks living downtown, and one of the things we're hearing is, I'm happy, but I'll need to move out as I have kids. We don't have amenities. He says the city has worked to address that concern downtown with the construction of a park on land under long-term loan from EMC Insurance on Walnut Street. He added, so we've built EMC on the west side, and this will help on the east side. East Village Park is still in the earliest planning stages with no funding or timeline for this development. Page noted that the project isn't in Des Moines' current capital improvement program that budgets 6 years out. And while work is underway to build the stormwater basin, residents won't see progress on that park anytime soon unless a private donor steps forward, as with the EMC and Mid-American parks. He says, we don't have any money in the budget, but we know it's important to have this plan ready. Notably absent from the plans for Mid-American-sponsored park, unveiled late last year, were a dedicated children's play area and sports facilities. A report from city staff says the park open space will allow for casual recreation opportunities. Now, with the development of East Village Park, those amenities could finally be within walking distance of the Market District and also the East Village and the Central Business District. Page added that the city's planning team was deliberate in not duplicating Two Rivers' design, but instead offering something not yet in the area. He said this one will have different facilities. Two Rivers is also meant to have more events, while this will be a neighborhood park.
And that concludes the stories from the Metro and Iowa section. We'll return now to the front page section and begin with a couple of Iowa stories before moving on to national stories. Here's the first one. The Department of Natural Resources says a farmer declines to clean up fertilizer. This is from Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A man whose large fertilizer tank ruptured while he was driving in Burlington did not report the spill, drove away from it, and initially refused to help clean a creek it contaminated, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Jeff Boyer, 65, of rural Oakville, was driving a truck and trailer near Burlington Notre Dame High School about 4:45 p.m. on April 22nd when a tank he was hauling shifted, broke open, and released up to 700 gallons of ammonium phosphate, according to the DNR. Boyer stopped briefly after noticing the spill and then left, according to DNR. He could not be reached for comment for this article. The spill covered a more than 1,000-foot stretch of roadway, and an unknown amount of the fertilizer flowed via a stormwater sewer into Hawkeye Creek, said Robert Burnt, fire marshal for the Burlington Fire Department. Another driver who has been following Boyer reported the spill. Burlington firefighters used about 3,000 pounds of absorbent material to clean the spill and to stop more of the fertilizer from going into the creek. The creek contamination did not appear to have resulted in a fish kill, said Anthony Kirker, an environmental specialist for the DNR, but it discolored the creek up to about a mile away from the spill site. Boyer pretty much refused to remedy the problem, according to the DNR, as required by state rules, which might have included pumping contaminated water out of the creek bed, Kirker said. The city eventually decided to flush the creek on Wednesday with about 200,000 gallons of water from a hydrant to dilute the contamination, Kirker said. The creek flows into the Mississippi River. City staff have been monitoring it closely, Kirker said. Still no signs of dead fish or other aquatic life, he said. The city plans to bill Boyer for cleanup, and he will likely face a separate penalty from the DNR, according to Kirker. Boyer owns cropland east of Oakville, about 20 miles north of Burlington, according to county records. He also operates a livestock confinement with about 1,600 swine. according to DNR records. And this story from the Iowa Capital Dispatch is part of which is part of the state's newsroom, a network of news bureaus supported by grants and a coalition of donors as a 501c3 public charity. And Iowa Capital Dispatch maintains its editorial independence and occasionally provides stories to the Des Moines Register.
A judge says claim that deputy wrongly seized dog egregious. This is from William Morris of the Des Moines Register. Dallas County law enforcement officers didn't just wrongly arrest and mistreat Lisa Kressinger in 2021. She alleges they also tried to steal her dog. Kressinger is 60 years old, alleged in a 2023 lawsuit that DeSoto police officer arrested her after a traffic stop, even though sobriety and breath test showed no alcohol in her system. She also accused the officer, who she said lacked the legal credentials to be a sworn peace officer, of unnecessary force and threats, and said that he kept her for more than an hour in a city shed, making her fear for her life before taking her to jail. All charges except a traffic ticket were later dismissed. But Kressinger also brought claims against against the county for the actions of a deputy sheriff who assisted at the scene. And last month, federal judge Rebecca Goodgame Ebinger allowed some of those claims to move forward. Ebinger found that the allegations that Deputy Aaron Sanchez took Kressinger's dog from the traffic stop and then falsely told an animal shelter it was a stray, nearly resulting in the dog's adoption, could amount to an unlawful seizure or civil theft, and called Sanchez's reported conduct egregious. Attorneys for Kressinger in Dallas County did not respond to messages looking for comment. But according to the court filing, Sanchez arrived at the scene to help out DeSoto officer Brandon Carter. As Carter arrested her, Kressinger asked what would happen to her car and her dog, a 10-pound Havanese named Norman. She says that she was told that her car would be towed and that Sanchez would take the dog. Sanchez then turned Norman over to a nearby animal shelter, Kressinger says, allegedly telling the staff the dog had been found wandering loose on the highway and that the owner was unknown. Although Kressinger says Norman was wearing a collar with vaccination tags before her arrest, he reportedly arrived at the shelter with neither. Believing that Norman was a stray, the shelter then posted a picture on social media and stated that he was available for adoption. After her release from jail, Kressinger saw the post and was able to reclaim her dog, but said that the shelter staff told her that they'd received several inquiries and that Norman would have been placed with a new owner soon had she not found him first. In court filings, the county argued that Sanchez acted properly and that Kressinger suffered no harm as a result, and sought to dismiss all the claims against it and the deputy. Ebinger dismissed the claims accusing Sanchez of wrongdoing related to Kressinger's arrest, but she did not dismiss the claims related to Norman. Not only did Sanchez allegedly lie to the shelter staff, Ebinger wrote, but did so after refusing Kressinger's offer to have a family member pick up the dog instead and may have removed his collar to make him harder to identify. Kressinger's allegations that the deputy Sanchez falsely represented that the dog's owner was unknown and that the dog was found wandering along the highway, along with the interference that Norman's collar and tag were removed prior to being received by the animal shelter, are sufficient to demonstrate Deputy Sanchez's actions were improper, she wrote. Now, as for the county's argument that Kressinger recovered her dog and thus suffered no harm, Ebinger wrote that the time and expense of retrieving that dog and the anguish of finding him missing are sufficient to support a claim. Ebinger's ruling means that Kressinger can now continue to seek to bring her dog-related class against Sanchez and Dallas County to trial. Kressinger's claims against DeSoto and Carter, who no longer works for the department, also remain active. This is according to court filings. This case is scheduled to go on trial in August of next year.
Overseas campus protests are not like the U.S. This story is from USA Today. From London to Geneva, dueling groups of pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel demonstrators in Europe have for months been holding solidarity rallies, marches, and vigils in connection with the Israel-Hamas war. But they do not look like the Columbia University protest encampments and confrontations, which now have spread to other U.S. universities. From October 7 last year to mid-April, there have been more than 3,100 demonstrations in Europe related to the war in the Gaza Strip. In the U.S., over the same period, there have been about 2,700 such events, according to data provided by the ACLED, an organization that tracks and analyzes global political activity and violence. Pro-Palestinian protesters have demanded a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and more aid for suffering Palestinians, called on their government to stop supporting arms to Israel, and urged other forms of divestment. Pro-Israel demonstrations have focused on raising awareness about the hostages held by Hamas and combating what they say is anti-Semitism that has made Jews feel less safe all around the world. But unlike in the U.S., where some of the most prestigious universities have been trying to diffuse campus tensions over the war, standoffs on European college campuses have either appeared limited or have flown under the radar. Precisely why that is, political experts and campaigners say, is not easy to explain. They say it could be because of different protesting cultures, demographics, speech laws, university regulations, policing habits, lack of viral traction on social media, and even opportunity. Some European governments have actively sought to place restrictions on the rights to protest in support of Palestinian rights. Some say these standoffs have taken place and the media has largely ignored them. Matt Beach, who directs the Center for British Politics at the University of Hull, said one reason there may be fewer combative on-campus protests in the UK compared to the US could be because there are regular, larger-scale demonstrations, most of them pro-Palestinian, in London and other British cities each Saturday. At these marches in London, which are routinely attended by tens of thousands of people, Beach says students may feel they are making a difference and having their voices heard as part of the bigger protest community where they have a bigger audience. The frequent pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel rallies in the U.S., by contrast, have not matched the ones in London each weekend. Beach, who also sometimes lectures and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, said the First Amendment may also explain why some U.S. campuses have erupted and Britain's have not over the Israel-Hamas war. The First Amendment, he said, allows students in the U.S. to engage publicly in what Beach described as robust exchanges involving, again in his words, unparliamentary language. Hate speech laws in the UK may act as a deterrent on what people are willing to say in a campus environment, when these statements can easily slide into Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, as both sides in the US campus protests say. Government action in Europe may also be a factor. In Germany, which has long viewed itself as having a unique responsibility to stand up for Jews and Israel because of the Holocaust, officials have repeatedly refused to authorize many pro-Palestinian protests, saying limits are needed to prevent public disorder and anti-Semitism. In France, home to large Muslim and Jewish communities, a series of legal proceedings ended with courts deciding to allow protests on a case-by-case basis after authorities said they could lead to incitement of hatred. In Britain, officials have threatened to revoke visas or expel foreign students who praise Hamas. The country has also given police new powers to arrest protesters who threaten or intimidate others during marches amid a large increase in anti-Semitic incidents since October 7. Stella Swain, a youth and student coordinator for the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, which describes itself as Europe's largest Palestinian advocacy organization, nevertheless said there have been student occupations of university campuses in the UK and elsewhere. It's just that nobody has paid much attention. Swain pointed out that student protesters at Goldsmiths University of London shut down some of the college's departments for more than a month earlier this year. The students demanded that the university cut all its ties with Israel's government and divest from companies that support Israel's military occupation of Palestinian territory. Similar protests have taken place in British colleges in Bristol and Leeds. However, Swain said, it would be very unusual for British police to be called to a student occupation, as has happened at Columbia, Yale, New York University, and other U.S. college campuses in recent days. She also claimed that there has been what she called a concerted effort by British authorities over the past decade to shut down the ability to organize protests and other advocacy on Palestinian-related issues. The protests in the UK and Europe, on and off campus, have not, in other words, been tension-free, even if ACLED data show the vast majority, more than 90%, have been peaceful. The figure for the U.S. is similar. In an emailed statement on Wednesday, Campaign Against Anti-Semitism said the hatred and objectives of anti-Semites on campuses in the UK is the same as in the US, namely, to intimidate Jewish students and ostracize them. That's the end of the quote from the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism email. But Palestinian lawmaker Mustafa Brugati disagreed with the assessment. He said in a WhatsApp message Thursday that the college campus protests in the U.S. resembled protests and activism against the war in Vietnam and South Africa's anti-apartheid movement. It will spread to other universities in the world, he predicted.
And this next story, IVF clinic sued for alleged lab incident. A suit says that a California facility destroyed embryos but then still implanted them. This is another story from the USA Today. An IVF clinic in Newport Beach, California is being sued by 9 couples alleging that a catastrophic failure at its laboratory caused embryos to be destroyed by lethal hydrogen peroxide before multiple failed implantations. This is according to one of the attorneys on the case. A civil suit against Ovation Fertility was filed on April 23rd in the California Supreme Court in Orange County by the couples who all feel devastated by what has happened. This is according to Rob Marcero, an attorney representing the plaintiffs, said during a phone interview. Ovation Fertility destroyed our last 2 embryos. It was devastating physically and emotionally to learn that after I had endured all the injections, medications, and painful and invasive procedures, it ultimately was for nothing. Brooke Berger said in a news release about her IVF experience with Ovation. She then continued to say, "We want to ensure that Ovation is held accountable for these entirely preventable errors and that this doesn't happen again to other couples who are trying to grow their families." Berger and her husband, Bennett Hardy, called Ovation's actions an alleged cover-up and said that they hope that the suit will reveal the complete truth of what happened before, during, and after the failed implantations. The couples in the suit, many of whom have not been publicly identified, believe that Ovation tried tricking patients into signing waivers of legal claims and non-disparagement agreements, according to the lawsuit. Hardy said in the release, "It's heartbreaking and frustrating thinking about all the effort that we went through and my wife sacrificing her body physically and mentally with this exhausting process, only to discover the incompetence and a cover-up by Ovation Fertility." USA Today contacted Ovation multiple times on Thursday, but they did not get a response. According to a statement obtained by the LA Times, the company says the issue was a one-off occurrence because of a lab error. So what did the clinic allegedly do? The alleged laboratory failure happened between January 18th and January 30th during the pre-implementation thawing process at Ovation's Newport Beach lab, according to the lawsuit. Now, once the incident happened, Ovation did not disclose it to the couples, the lawsuit says. The failed pregnancies led to weeks of the couples blaming themselves and their bodies, with some enduring medical procedures like I think it's hysteroscopies and biopsies to try and find out what went wrong, according to the complaint. These embryos, which are dead, were implanted into these hopeful mothers without their knowledge, Mercero says during the phone interview. They had to undergo this invasive implantation process, hoping to become pregnant, and never had a chance. To remedy the situation, Mercero and the suit alleged that Ovation offered partial refunds for lab fees. Skepticism arose when the company told the couples that to receive the money, they had to sign a gag order and agree not to make any claims against them, according to Marcereau. The couples in the suit are seeking medical and other special damages, damages from loss of earnings and other monetary benefits, punitive damages, and also past, present, and future non-economic damages in an amount to be determined at the time of trial. Ovation has protocols in place to protect the health and integrity of every embryo under our care, according to the statement that's obtained by the LA Times. The company went on to call alleged misconduct an isolated incident that's related to an unintended laboratory technician error that impacted a very small number of patients, the California-based outlet reported. And according to the statement, the LA Times said, as soon as that we recognized that pregnancy numbers were lower than our usually high success rates, we immediately initiated an investigation. We did not knowingly transfer non-viable embryos for implantation. We have been in close contact with these few impacted patients since the issue was discovered. We are grateful for the opportunity to help patients build a family and will continue to implement and enforce rigorous protocols to safeguard that process. The suit includes an unnamed Ovation employee who says the issues in the company's labs are not a one-off, but systematic, Marcereau says. The whistleblower says that there have been numerous instances of lab failures that resulted in lost embryos, according to the attorney. Right now, 9 couples are represented in the lawsuit, but Marcereau says the total number will likely be over 20. Marcereau says that he and the other attorneys attached to the suit are in the process of speaking to 6 to 7 more couples who they believe were affected by Ovation's alleged wrongdoing. Finding out what happened is one of Marcereau's and his plaintiff's goals because he says the fertility medicine industry is not regulated at all. According to Marcereau, hair salons have more regulation than fertility medicine. There needs to be legislation and regulations that these kind of things don't continue to happen. There needs to be regulation about the qualifications of people who can operate and work in labs. There needs to be regulations regarding protocols for the storage and throwing of embryos. Alabama lawmakers passed IVF protections in March that protect providers and patients. This legislation came less than a month after the state Supreme Court upended fertility practices by ruling that frozen embryos are legally protected as children. In vitro fertilization, also known as IVF, is a costly medical procedure that does involve combining eggs and sperm in a lab dish before transferring the fertilized eggs into a woman's uterus, according to the Yale Medicine. A single IVF cycle can cost from $15,000 to $30,000. That is depending on the medical center and the patient's medication needs, Forbes reported.
And before we continue with more news stories, we are leading up to our birthday segment, so I'm going to read a few of the short blurbs from USA Today's 50 State Roundup leading into the top of the hour. The first is the highlight, which is from Ohio, Cleveland. This dog's bark may or may not be worse than its bite, but its breath definitely tops both. Throwflame, a company out of Cleveland, has combined its ARC flamethrower with a robotic dog to create the Therminator. There's a picture of this thing, and it's got 4 legs, and it looks sort of like a dog with a flamethrower on its back, but no head. Kind of a weird-looking thing here. Anyway, that's the Therminator. Billed as the first-ever flamethrower-wielding robot dog, the Therminator sells for $9,420, according to its listing. According to Throwflame, the Therminator has a 30-foot range and a 1-hour battery life, and is Wi-Fi and Bluetooth enabled. Its uses include wildlife control, agricultural management, ecological conservation, snow and ice removal, as well as entertainment and special effects. I'm just floored by that story. Anyway, that's the flamethrower, and you can buy it for less than $10,000. There's also a brief story here from Iowa that was not covered in the Register. In the past 4 years, officers in 4 metro police departments, Clive, Johnston, Urbandale, and West Des Moines, together logged more than 35,000 hours of overtime, according to a Des Moines Register review of data from each department.